It is a privilege to be here today, passing on to you the teachings of my great teacher, Shunryu Suzuki Roshi. And by passing on his teachings, passing on the meaning of the teachings of all the great Buddhist ancestors, all the way back to Shakyamuni Buddha. Today, because I can, because I was there when Roshi gave these talks on the Sandokai, I thought it would be nice to give you a little bit of local color. And my book, Pale Sky, I'll just hold this up, I don't know if you can see, is a poem that takes place during what's called the Rohatsu Sesshin, which is considered the most difficult Sesshin of the year because the last night, on the seventh night, we stay up all night and the Sesshin ends after breakfast on the eighth morning, which is the day of Buddha's enlightenment, December 8th. So even though this Sesshin, where this book, the setting of this book, takes place in the first week of December in 1971, and the Sandokai lectures were given in the summer of 1970, still I think you'll be able to take in the feeling of the space. And also, at the end of this little passage I'm going to read, my mind, you know, wanders to the Sandokai lectures, and you'll hear stupid me being there. So this is Tassajara during the Rohatsu Sesshin. I think you'll understand. So, clang, 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 clang. The obstreperous bell, having awakened her at its loudest, was fading. Eliza gazed into the sky. Millions, trillions, gazillions of unbelievably sparkling stars shone from a blanket of blackness. This blackness is endless and arises from inside me, she sighed wistfully. She lay staring at a star and beyond it, the rising triangle of some nameless constellation. From the moment I enter the Zendo, I am changed. The fragrance, the clarity, stir a deadness in me that I've lugged around and lugged around. I recognize it with my teeth, behind my ears, between my toes, the bottoms of my feet. It is startling and immediate. The same sense, almost a nostalgia, filters through the air, the grounds, the trees, people talking, jays cawing. It's just a caw, but its rawness makes a point and repeats the point and repeats the point. I'm hearing the empty beginning before the person or the jay get involved. Even the air rattles with its mind. The sound is fresh. It stays cool in the heat. Beyond immaculate, its cleanness is original. The wind in the trees is crisper. Leaves are more defined. Colors are subtler, as if elsewhere, even elsewhere in the same range of mountains, this feeling is quelled by the lack of an inherited intelligence. The Legacy of Mind, Big Mind, Zen Mind establishes the legitimacy even of the pansies. Traipsing in my gaitas down the rain-drenched path, my muscles know precisely the beyond knowing of its importance. Like a nocturnal bird seeks a safe place to rest during the day in a vacant attic, chirps and caws sprinkle through the air as dawn hits the trees and pale sky colors the brick wall that I am staring at. It's this path, but it's the sky and the eon sky and the yuga's sky and all the yuga's skies. One, she said mentally, listening to the soft stream of air through her nostrils. Two, started at the top while the air was in her nose, but the sound, slower now and more nasal, seemed to be coming from her throat. Three, though the three came as an afterthought. The person to her right was leaning forward on his knees, trying to fit a third zafu under his buttocks, but the second one kept slipping, making the third one lopsided. Eliza stayed still, steadying her gaze. She continued counting exhales, but her mind went to the day she'd so wanted to make a personal connection. Is there anything I should bring? She twaddled the strand of hair too tightly around a finger. He yawned with his jaw without opening his mouth. You'll be doing the personal lists. It wasn't really an answer. Then he'd simply stood, absorbed in looking out. She wished he wouldn't shift around on his pillow so much. How is your practice? Her Doksan had been short. It's so young, she crooned afterwards, seeing a budding ginkgo bursting from itself, full of intention and purpose. Its fragile limbs, every which way, jutted out awkwardly, extending her finger gently to touch the blossoms. She was startled, but felt an inexpressible affection for the plant. The mind of the great sage of India is intimately transmitted from west to east, began the Roshi, carefully reading the translation. It had been a typical Sesshin day. Hot afternoon sun poured through the Zendo windows. He was winding down a series on the Sando Kai, an ancient Chinese poem routinely chanted in the liturgy. Clearly enjoying the task, he'd set up a blackboard next to his seat where he wrote and explained each of Sekito Kisan's characters. Eliza wasn't listening. Instead, she was attending to him. I made it up, he grinned when a student asked about a word. Is intimately transmitted, the Roshi continued. Mitsuni means exactly, without a gap between the two. The main purpose of the Sando Kai is to show reality from two sides. It had rained till dawn, a warm summery rain, and the Zendo was starting to feel stuffy. As I said, San means many, Do means one. What does it matter? I don't care about the Japanese. So many is right and one is right, she heard him say a few minutes later. She was staring out the window. Do you have a question? It woke her up. Roshi, could we just work from the Japanese and forget the English translation? It was a man, one of the older students. How could he want even more fussing, her mind railed. Yes, he was trying to do that, the Roshi explained. The poem was full of technical terms that, without understanding, oh my God, she closed her eyes to try to retrieve her centeredness. Oh my God, it came again, less strong but still there. Oh my God, started to arise. How deep is it now? Has it buried the pampas grass yet? That's all I'm going to read. But I hope that gives you a sense of the zendo and minds wandering in the zendo, Roshi trying to teach. What I didn't know when I wrote this, and I'm sorry a little bit, but I still, that was my experience. So, but what I didn't know is that many of Roshi's students, this was 1970, and he came in 62, and many of his older students had taken the trouble to learn Japanese and to study the sutras in Japanese. And Roshi knew that, and I think actually he was talking to his senior students when he gave these Sandokai lectures. Just to know that. I was not a senior student. I came in the tail end of 68. And, you know, I just wanted him to say something that I could understand. So that's that. I just wanted to give you that. So this poem, the place in the poem that we actually started last week, I'll reread that. Eye and sight, ear and sound, nose and smell, tongue and taste, thus for each and everything, depending on these roots, the leaves spread forth. Trunk and branches share the essence, revered and common, each has its speech. So in our last talk, Roshi explained the meaning of independency, his own word, that actually does what it says. Its independency is both independent and interdependent. So when each being includes the whole world, then each being is actually independent. That's what independency means. And then today he explains these lines from the Sandokai from the viewpoint of independency. So Roshi says, eye and sight, ear and sound, nose and smell, tongue and taste, it looks as if Sekido is actually talking dualistically about the dependency of eyes on their objects. But when you see something, if you see it in its true sense, there is nothing to be seen and no one to see it. Only when you analyze it is there someone seeing something and something that is seen. It is one activity that can be understood in two ways. I see something, but really, there was no one seeing it and nothing to be seen. Both of these are true. Here, Sekido is talking about this oneness of eye and form. This is how Buddhists observe things. We understand things. This is a really important sentence. We understand things in a dualistic way, but we don't forget that our understanding is dualistic. We understand things in a dualistic way, but we don't forget that our understanding is dualistic. Maybe you will kill some animal or insect, but when you think, there are many earwigs here and they are harmful insects, so I have to kill them, you understand things only in a dualistic way. Actually, earwigs and human beings are one. They are not different. It is impossible to kill an earwig. Even though we think we have killed it, we have not. Even though you squash the earwig, it is still alive. That momentary form may vanish, but as long as the whole world, including us, exists, we cannot kill an earwig. When we come to this understanding, we can keep our precepts completely. The precept being not to kill. Basically, Roshi's saying that you can observe the world from a dualistic viewpoint and from an absolute viewpoint, which is Buddha nature. It is not good to kill is the dualistic viewpoint. Even though you think you killed, you did not kill is the absolute viewpoint. Understanding things in this way, we have oneness. So both are true, and we just need to keep that in mind. And furthermore, he explains, I find this really interesting, excusing your action through some reasoning, well, I had to because, is not our way. This is not our way. You may think if there are precepts, do not kill, you should observe them literally, or else you cannot be Buddhists. But if you feel good, just because you observe some precept, trying to make yourself feel good through religious activity or by observing precepts, that is not the Buddhist way. Trying to make yourself feel good through religious activity or by observing precepts, do not kill, that is not the Buddhist way. Actually, when you kill an animal, you don't feel so good. But even though you violate your precepts, if after doing it, you feel very sorry, if you say, I am so sorry to the earwig, that is Buddha's way. That is Buddha's way. Do you see the difference? The second way brings your heart to the matter, which includes everyone, and compassion to the matter. And it isn't just a kind of stricture. I am so sorry. That's Buddha's way. Roshi said the Buddhist way is one word, jihi, which means compassion. Jihi means to encourage people when they are feeling positive and also to help them get rid of suffering. That is true love. We've talked about this before. It is not just to give something or to receive something or to observe precepts that we practice our way. We practice our way with things as they naturally occur. Going with people, suffering with them, helping to relieve their suffering, and encouraging them to go on and on. That is how we observe the precepts. We see something, but we do not see something. We always feel the oneness of the subjective and objective worlds, the oneness of eye and form, the oneness of tongue and taste, so we don't have to attach to something in a special way, and we don't have to feel especially good because of our Buddhist practice. When we practice in this way, we are independent, and that's what Sakito is talking about. Without any idea of attainment, without any idea of doing anything, without any idea of meaningful practice, just to sit is our way. To be completely involved in sitting is our zazen. And this is how we observe our precepts. Sometimes we will be angry, sometimes we will smile, sometimes we will be mad at our friends, and sometimes we will give them a kind word. But actually, what we are doing is just observing our way. And then Roshi says, I can't explain it so well, but I think you must understand what I mean. So good luck. But then I want to share this with you. there was discussion after that. And some of the questions I think are very are helpful. So I want to share these with you. One student said, I don't feel that talking about Buddhism or the Sandokai is the same as my life or my practice. I feel some separation. Talking about it seems like something else. It's way out there. Roshi says, I felt that way myself for a pretty long time. It is rather difficult to communicate some feeling through my talk. This is why the old masters twisted their students' noses. Right here, what are you thinking about? In short, that is the point. Roshi says, I'm going around and around the point, so I'm using words. We speak, and this is a wonderful metaphor, we speak of scratching an itchy foot with our shoe on. It doesn't help so much, but even so, I have to talk. That's what Roshi says. Another student says, you said that when we kill an earwig or an insect, we can't kill it as long as everything is there. Do you mean that each thing will always be each thing? This lecture will always be this lecture? And Roshi says, when you see things as it is so. The student continues, if the body of the earwig dies, what happens to the earwig's karma? Where does the earwig go? Roshi, earwigs go to the source of reality. They know where to go. We speak in this way. When we speak in this way, you will feel that it is just talk. But when you suffer a lot, it will be a great relief to know that. I know that Roshi has suffered a lot, and I think he's talking about that, and that he felt a great relief knowing that. Earwigs go to the source of reality. They know where to go. Another student says, Roshi, every animal has a way of living, of eating, of raising its young, of relating to its world that is in keeping with a particular dharma or Tao of its being. Does mankind also have a particular way of living and eating and raising our young that is in keeping with our dharma or Tao? I think this is such an interesting answer. Not absolutely. Rather, we have to make our best effort to keep the Dharma. That's what these words are about. Words are necessary, but even though they are necessary, you shouldn't think they are complete. We should make a constant effort to produce new Dharma, new precepts. We say, this is human life, but this human life is for today, not tomorrow. Tomorrow, we must have better ways to live. This kind of effort should be continued. When we feel bad, it means we should improve our way. But you should not expect a perfect Dharma that says clearly, you should or you shouldn't. No one can insist on their own way, but we should appreciate their effort to improve the Dharma. Does this make sense? That's what Roshi said. So here are the most important points from today's talk. I see something, but really there is no seeing it and nothing to be seen. Both of these are true. The second point, we practice our way with things as they naturally occur, going with people, suffering with them, helping to relieve their suffering and encouraging them to go on and on. So we practice our way with things as they naturally occur. Even though you violate your precepts, if after doing it you feel very sorry, if you say, "I am sorry," to the earwig, it is Buddha's way. In this way, our practice will go on and on. Without any idea of attainment, without any idea of doing anything, without any idea of meaningful practice, just to sit is our way. And this last point, we should make a constant effort to produce new dharma, new precepts. We say this is human life, but this human life is for today, not tomorrow. Tomorrow, we must have better ways to live. This kind of effort should be continued. We should always try to improve the precepts that we live by. Just make new ones. And some things for you to think about during the week. And you know, if you keep a notebook, every once in a while, you should go back and reread your notebook, because it will help you to integrate the things that you've made a point to remember. So one thing you can think about during the week, the passages from Pale Sky that I read, did they give you a sense of the space wherein the Sandokai was explicated? Is there anything you can take from that space for your practice? Just to think about that. And this point about we understand things in a dualistic way, but we don't forget that our understanding is dualistic. What can you do not to forget, to remind yourself every once in a while? What can you actually do not to forget that just about everything we think is from a dualistic viewpoint? And thirdly, make a new precept every month and write it down. Make your own book of Dharma, spiritual laws. Things change. Things happen. There are new ways we need to respond to them that are correct and come from a deep understanding. Earwigs go to the source of reality. They know where to go. When we speak in this way, you will feel that is just talk, but when you suffer a lot, it will be a great relief to know that. Do you believe this? Have you ever had a taste of it? I wonder if there are questions.
We have a first question. We should make constant effort to produce new dharma, new precepts. How can I, little me, produce new dharmas or make a new precept?
Well, I want to tell you, in the beginning, there were no precepts. Buddha and his disciples just lived harmoniously according to the monastic schedule. And they just, everybody followed this. It was a very spacious schedule. But then someone did something. I'm pretty sure it was a monk who went to visit his ex-wife, and allowed her to persuade him, again, really guilt trip him, into giving her a baby. And the monk had taken a vow of celibacy. So when he came back, kind of everyone was outraged. And at that point, a precept was made. So the precept about what happens to a monk who doesn't keep his vows. But it's the same with you. If you're a parent, you've probably made a million precepts about what your children should or shouldn't do. And in that way, parents are teachers also. And if you're single, you've also undoubtedly discovered, no, I'm not going to do such and such ever again. It just doesn't work. Things like that, that are basically dharma. They're basically how you should live properly. And again, the best ones come from a deep understanding of living compassionately and with respect for yourself and other beings. We can't be oblivious to the fact that everything is changing. We have to respond, and respond in meaningful ways that improve the way we have interdependency. That's all.
The next question that we have is, can you say a little about what's the difference between us understanding things in a dualistic way and us not forgetting that our understanding is dualistic too?
There isn't a difference. Maybe you're asking, we understand in a dualistic way, and we understand that our understanding is dualistic. The point of that is that we remember that there's an absolute way. So, do not kill is a dualistic precept, because it presumes that there's you and there's something to be killed, and that you killed it, or you might kill it, or can kill it. And then the absolute way is there's no you and there's no earwig, and it's impossible for you to kill the earwig bee as long as the beings exist, because we are all interrelated. As long as the interrelated world exists, you can't kill anything, because everything is interrelated. I'm not sure I answered your question, but that's the best I can do.
So we have the second question, but I think you have answered it already, but you can decide if you want to say more. The question is, it is impossible to kill an earwig. I hear these words and my mind goes blank. How are we supposed to understand this?
So Roshi says that we're talking about something that's impossible to talk about. That's why he always sort of goes, oh, well, I have to talk, so here goes. But he also used this metaphor that I think is really helpful. He says that all his talk is like a finger pointing to the moon. And once you're on the moon, once you really get the moon, you don't need the finger pointing to it. And all this talk is about a finger pointing to the moon. And the finger is not the important point. The Buddhist way is not the words, but the meaning behind the words. But even having, and I found this so helpful, even having an intellectual understanding, Roshi says, can help us, because we can remember that what we think we know is not complete. That's all. We can just know that. We know that what we think we know is not complete. It's just one side of reality. That's this idea of the finger pointing to the moon is not the moon. He's said that again and again, and I think it's helpful.
Thank you, Gail. So the next question we have is the source of reality the same thing as Buddha way?
As Buddha nature. The source of reality and Buddha nature are the same. So the earwig basically dissolves into its Buddha nature, which is the source. And so will we. So when Roshi was dying, he told his close students, "Don't worry about me. I know who I am." And who he was Buddha nature, and he was just going to dissolve into his own source. I myself have found that very helpful, very helpful, in terms of being afraid of death or, oh my God, you know, hell or whatever, all these things. This strikes at least me as so real, because we already see our bodies changing every single day. And so it will just continue changing every single day. That's all. I find that very helpful myself. That's all.
So somebody shared that regarding killing an earwig, what is the difference between having a good reason to kill it, which justifies killing it in your mind? For example, earwigs are destroying our food, so we have to kill them. And simply telling the earwig you're sorry. Roshi said the former is not our way, but the latter is. I don't really understand the difference.
One is a rule, thou shalt not kill. And one is a heartfelt, compassionate transmission from your heart to the earwig that you're so sorry. And that is in the realm of compassion. So one is sort of like the stricture. It's just full of itself, kind of. And one is fundamentally, I mean, Roshi said that jihi, compassion, is what Buddhism is all about. Buddhism and compassion are the same. And feeling from your heart compassion for the earwig that just got its body smashed is very different from a rule that says, thou shalt not kill. It's coming from an entirely different place and radiates an entirely different energy. Just try to feel into that. That's all.
Okay, so somebody shared that even though you violate your precepts, if after doing it you feel very sorry, if you say I'm sorry to the earwig, it is Buddha's way. There is something so natural about this. I love hearing that a heartfelt apology helps because it is there, but I never think to say it. Thank you.
I know. I know. We forget easily. It brings up that idea I talked about last week from Alexander technique of stopping to have a practice of just stopping at various points during the day so that you don't just continue with your habitual, you know, you don't kind of fall into your habitual ways. And stopping, so if you stopped, you kill the earwig and you stop, you may actually feel sorry that you had to do that. And then you would apologize. And then the whole event would be complete. It will complete itself through your apology. So this stopping, it's hard. It's hard to remember. But if you can make a point of remembering or set yourself, you know, I'm going to stop 5 times every day and then stop. I think it's a very wise practice. And that's a good place for it. Thank you.
So we have another very interesting comment. So this question goes back a few talks to the idea of taking the blue jay into your heart. Feeling connected to or feeling one with the blue jay or anything in the natural world seems easier to do than to do so with other people. For example, today my neighbor keeps turning on and off his lawnmower, and so I have to raise and lower the volume on your talk. It is disturbing. I guess this is not a question but a comment on how it is odd that it is more difficult to accept what is closest to us.
So that's another place of where you can stop. You know, you hear the lawnmower, you just hear the lawnmower, and then you just keep listening to the lawnmower. And keep listening to the lawnmower. And pretty soon you forget the lawnmower is even there and you're just sitting. And that can happen. Another way to do the same thing is consider this poor man who has a lawn and has to keep it mowed for the sake of the neighborhood or whatever. And there he is on Sunday having to do this and to just feel compassion for not being able to have brunch instead or some whatever. I'm just making this up, but the point is that another way to go, the best way is what I already said. Try to listen deeply to the sound of the lawnmower. Go directly into that sound and stay there. And the other way I'm suggesting is feeling compassionate for the man and finding a way to feel compassion for the man, even if you make it up. It's a good question, though. Thank you.
So somebody shared, when you say practice our way with things as they naturally occur, going with people, suffering with them, helping to relieve their suffering and encouraging them to go on and on. This is tangible and something I can focus on accomplishing. It helps me to feel that I am practicing.
Roshi often adds to that, when we practice this way, we are independent. And then having a true sense of our independence helps us to cultivate interdependence. And going on and on in this way, independent interdependence, is a good way, even if you're not a Buddhist, because this is about reality. People get, I can't listen to any Buddhist teachings because I'm a Christian and, you know, these are going to violate my heart of my connection to the Christian way. And the two cover are really different. Buddhism covers a different territory. This idea of dependence and interdependence being the same thing. Maybe it is covered. I shouldn't really say that. But no matter what you are, this kind of understanding is important. That's all.
So the next one is, can you say a little more about when you said, I see something, but really there is no one seeing it and nothing to be seen. Both of these are true.
It's harder to see there's no one to see and nothing to be seen. We just have to really have confidence that enlightened beings who tell us this are accurate. But we just need to remember that it's the finger pointing to the moon. All these words are just words. They're the finger pointing to the moon. They're not the moon. They're just words. But Roshi says, even though they're just words, when we suffer, they can be a great relief to us. If there are no more questions, I sort of would like to tell you a story about what I know about Roshi's suffering.
Yes, Gail, that was the last question. Please go ahead.
You know, it's really funny that I have never heard this portion of Roshi's life talked about, except once when I read it in a biography. And it's so startling, and it's shocking and horrible. And I just brace yourself. It's a terrible story. But I just think about it all the time because I did read it, and I just wonder, how did Roshi ever recover? Roshi was married and had children with his first wife, and she died. And then he married again, and I don't know, he might have had one child. I'm not sure about the children. He married again, and also, simultaneous to all this marriage stuff, he had his teacher, the teacher from whom he received Dharma transmission and whose temple he inherited There was that teacher. But he respected and learned the things that were most important to him from this other teacher, whose name starts with a K. I don't remember his name. And Roshi considers the second teacher his real teacher, and the first teacher kind of the person he received Dharma transmission from, and he inherited the temple and so forth, but his real learning came from this other teacher, K. And the other teacher at one point asked Roshi to take in to his monastic compound a man that really didn't quite fit into his monastic compound as a favor to him. And so Roshi took this man in, and no one in the family liked him. And no one in the family, everyone felt funny around him, and slightly unsafe and just funny around this man. And they said to him, please please ask your teacher to take this man back. It's not good for us to have him here. And so Roshi went back to his teacher and said that. And the teacher said, please keep him. Please keep him. And so this is Roshi's teacher. It's as if Roshi were saying to me, please keep him. It's something you just do. So despite his family, he kept the man. And one day, everybody in the family was away for whatever reason, and the man and Roshi's wife were the only people left there. And the man took an axe and he killed Roshi's wife with his axe. So the man belonged in a mental institution. That was the correct place. No one would do that. And so this was the result. And I think about this a lot when Roshi talks about suffering. And he says, even though you don't understand this, when you suffer a lot, it can be a great relief. I always think that this is what he's thinking about. Later, when he came to America to be the resident priest for the Soto Zen Japanese community, he had to have a wife. He just had to have a wife. That's all there is to it. And so there was a woman who was very well known for her kind of brilliance in running this kindergarten. And Roshi had a kindergarten too, and he asked her to run his kindergarten also when he was going to America. But then when he needed a wife, everyone said, she's the one, you have to have her as your wife. So it wasn't like, I mean, they had been good friends for years, but it wasn't like they were in love or anything like that. But she accepted, and about 6 months or so, I'm not sure how long, after he came, she came finally to join him. And, I think they were very fond of each other, and they had a very sort of joking, cordial relationship. I don't know anything more than that. But she's the one who, when Roshi would be overworking at Tassajara, we already knew he was dying of cancer, and she would say, she would walk by, and Roshi would get ashamed to be working and caught working, so he'd rest. And then as soon as she went by, he'd start working again. That was the third wife. I don't know. I'm telling you this story because When Roshi talks about suffering, I feel that he has suffered unbelievably. And I just want you to know that. It isn't just a word that he's flinging around. He knows about suffering, as we all do, really. I hope that wasn't inappropriate to tell you that story. And I'm so surprised that you just never hear about it. And it just feels so important to me.
Thanks for sharing this. We got one question right before you started telling the story. And the question is, I have heard that someone I know and care about has had a serious health diagnosis and is depressed about it. I want to call and show compassion, but I don't know if this is too direct. Is a note better?
You know, this is, Roshi is very clear about this. The Buddhist way, our way, is to, when we see someone suffering, we join them in their suffering. We join them in their suffering. If there's nothing we can do to fix it, we join them in their suffering. And so, whatever way you feel you can join this person in their suffering, you should do it. Absolutely. That's all.
Thank you, Gail. So we only have 2 minutes left now, and that was the last question.
Okay. Well, thank you for being here, and I will see you next week. Bye-bye.